If I was Universal Time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting a warning about U.S. security threats. The head of U.S. National Intelligence, James Clapper, told U.S. lawmakers Tuesday the United States faces an array of security threats this year, including the area of cybersecurity.
Cybercriminals remain the most pervasive cyber threat to the U.S. financial sector. They use cyber to conduct theft, extortion, and other criminal activities.
Speaking to the Senate Armed Services Committee, Clapper, in his annual assessment, said the Islamic State remains the preeminent terrorist threat in the world. The director of Defense Intelligence Agency said the IS group aims to carry out more attacks in Europe this year. He also spoke of the threat posed by North Korea's nuclear and missile ambitions.
In early January, North Korea issued a statement claiming that it had successfully carried out a nuclear test. And a couple days ago, they conducted their sixth space launch. This launch was the second launch to place a satellite into orbit. The DPRK display of a new or modified mobile ICBM during their recent parade, and its 2015 test of a new submarine-launched ballistic missile capability further highlight Pyongyang's commitment to diversifying its missile force and nuclear delivery options.
Director Clapper said North Korea has restarted a plutonium reactor and equated Russia's global assertiveness as another Cold War-like spiral. Kenya's Olympic team held out the possibility it may not attend the Summer Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro this year because of the outbreak of the Zika virus. The mosquito-borne illness may be linked to birth defects, prompting concerns among athletes and sporting officials. Kenya's Olympic Committee chairman said his group is preparing to attend the Games, pending decisions of Brazilian and Olympic sporting authorities. This is VOA News. A suicide car bomber struck near a police officer's club in Damascus Tuesday, killing at least 10, wounding 20, in an attack claimed by the Islamic State. The group also claimed responsibility for last month's blast in the Syrian capital, where the country's holiest Shia Muslim shrine is located. That blast killed more than 70 people. The UN has warned that hundreds of thousands of civilians could be cut off from food if Syrian forces encircle the divided northern city of Aleppo, partially held by rebel forces. It could result in a massive exodus of refugees to Turkey. William Spindler, spokesman for the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Refugees, urged Ankara to open its border to refugees.
Turkey has also allowed a number of vulnerable and wounded people in Turkey. However, many people are not being allowed to cross the border, and we are asking Turkey to open its border to all civilians from Syria who are fleeing danger and seeking international protection, as they have done since the start of this crisis.
Turkey has already given refuge to some 2.5 million Syrians. Its closed border makes it difficult to deliver humanitarian aid to those refugees still on the Syrian frontier. The Turkish Foreign Ministry summoned the U.S. Ambassador John Bass Tuesday to express irritation over remarks about a Kurdish political party and an armed militia in Syria. A U.S. spokesman says Washington does not recognize the PYD, or Democratic Union Party, as a terrorist organization. Turkey regards that group and the Kurdish People's Protection Units, affiliates of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, which has been fighting a 30-year guerrilla war for greater Kurdish political and civil rights. Socialist Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and billionaire businessman Donald Trump both won their respective Democratic and Republican New Hampshire primaries. Sanders addressed his supporters shortly after the results were made public.
Together, we have sent the message that will echo from Wall Street to Washington, from Maine to California.
Sanders narrowly lost to former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in last week's Iowa caucuses. Trump also addressed his supporters.
We are going to make America great again, but we're going to do it the old-fashioned way. We're going to beat China, Japan. We're going to beat Mexico at trade. We're going to beat all of these countries that are taking so much of our money away from us.
It was a big comeback win for Trump, who finished a disappointing second in Iowa behind Texas Senator Ted Cruz. The South African opposition Tuesday asked the Constitutional Court, the country's highest, to rule on whether President Jacob Zuma broke the law by spending over $20 million on a state-funded security upgrade of his private home. A 2014 report said Mr. Zuma personally benefited from some of the improvements. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today's Wednesday, February 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. There is a call for an independent investigation into the death of a prominent Liberian politician. Simeon Freeman is the leader of the opposition movement for progressive change in Liberia. Cameroon youth decry high unemployment, and a Zimbabwean man has been sentenced for planning to bomb a dairy farm belonging to President Robert Mugabe.
Obviously, we are in pain about it, but we've seen that the judgment has considered his plight as well. I think he showed a lot of contrition, and the judge took note of that.
Casino's Musa Kanda is the cousin of the Zimbabwe man jailed for planning to bomb a Mugabe farm. A former Australian hostage vows to stay in Burkina Faso. Women in South Sudan's Jonglei state demand the deputy governorship, and the Red Cross kills up community action to combat the Zika virus. Those stories plus Mark Oman's sports and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A Liberian opposition leader is calling for an independent investigation into the mysterious death of a prominent citizen, Harry Greaves, whose naked body was discovered January 31, 2016, on the beach behind the Liberian Ministry of Foreign Affairs building in Monrovia. A pathologist hired by the Liberian government from the U.S. state of Montana said Mr. Greaves died from drowning. Simeon Freeman is the leader of the opposition movement for progressive change in Liberia. He is wanted for questioning by the police after accusing the government of having a blacklist of politicians and critics of President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Mr. Simeon called us from an undisclosed location to say he was simply expressing the prevailing sentiments of the Liberian people.
I'll tell you what, Mr. Buffett, these are not even my expressions. We are public figures and we read things in a public space. If you tune into a radio station in the morning, you hear tons of what callers say. When you read social media, I'm sure you've had experience, you see tons of what people say. You read newspapers. In fact, some of the first newspapers, like Harper, was there, there was a blacklist that people should be careful. All of these things, we have a responsibility when we read them and we see that somebody died on a mysterious circumstance, we have a responsibility to elevate the conversation and say, hey, policymakers, this is the situation. Can you, under the circumstance, take the rightful actions that will instill confidence in the people? Instead of holding on to the positive suggestions we've made, what they are holding on to is my presence. Now, what does my presence have to do with what is currently unfolding in the country? The greatest threat to national security is not my presence or the things that I have said. The greatest threat to national security is the underfunding of the police that have made it a vehicle to be exploited by criminal and criminal elements. When people go to bed and have no security, that's the greatest threat. So it is the action of policymakers that's causing the threat and not those who talk about it in the first place.
You were quoted as saying in the press, as saying that if anybody was an enemy of the government, it would be Harry Greaves, because you mentioned that he had strong enemies within the structure of the state. Why did you say that?
Well, obviously, Harry Greaves was a serious champion for cheap electricity. Harry Greaves' network that was published by Front Page Africa showed some of the strong opposition that he had to deal with coming from state enterprises regarding the electricity issue. So he took on a monumental thing, and obviously that generated for him strong enemies.
There are reports that the autopsy of Mr. Reeves' body has been released, concluding that he died from drowning. What do you make of that?
Well, first thing, the process of selecting the pathologist was itself shrouded in secrecy. When you have such a high-profile investigation, you firstly publish the biodata of the pathologist for review. It is also reported today in one of the dailies that have been read that the pathologists have credibility issues. So if the pathologists have credibility issues, that ultimately brings into disrepute the report that he put forward. And I think if the government acting in good faith, it's important to set up this committee that we talked about and let us force a pathologist that has poor record. Let the pathologist come and conduct his examination on a very clear circumstances where public trust can be restored.
According to what we know, your house in Monrovia had been surrounded by security forces. So how did you leave that city?
The thing is that I was attacking the streets, and we made contact with very powerful people near our capital who are very committed to the process of democracy, and they were able to get us out of Liberia. That's all I can say at this stage.
Simeon Fremont is the leader of the opposition movement for progressive change in Liberia. He said he was speaking with us from an undisclosed location somewhere in Africa, despite repeated requests to several government agencies, including the police and information ministry. No one from the Liberian government was immediately available to speak with us. A court in Zimbabwe has sentenced an opposition party leader to 9 years in prison after he admitted to plotting to bomb a dairy farm owned by President Robert Mugabe. The man said he wanted to make the leader feel how the populace is suffering. Sebastian Mofu reports for VOA from Harare.
Magistrate Hosea Mujaya sentenced the president of the little-known Zimbabwe People Front Party, Owen Kuchata, to 9 years in jail after he pleaded guilty to charges of court possession of weaponry for sabotage and money laundering for terrorism purposes, unquote. Kuchata was arrested last month with the other three men at Mugabe's farm about 30 kilometers north of Harare. Tuesday, Kuchata appeared in court alone and was sentenced to 11 years, two of which were suspended. Outside the court, his wife Joylin could only shed tears as he was escorted away by prison officials. His cousin Kasinos Musakanda held back tears as he summed up how the family felt about the sentence.
Obviously, we are in pain about it, but we've seen that the judgment is considered his plight as well. I think he showed a lot of contrition, and the judge took note of that. And we are happy at least they understood him in a way.
The contrition Musakanda refers to is several apologies Kuchata made to the court before he was sentenced. But he also said he wanted to bomb Mugabe's farm so the president could feel the suffering others in Zimbabwe are going through because of his policies. Kuchata is to appear in court next week with the other three men he was arrested with to face charges of treason, a crime that carries the death penalty in Zimbabwe. Court papers say, besides planning to bomb Mugabe's dairy farm, the four wanted to overthrow the president who has ruled the country for more than three decades and turns 92 in 2 weeks' time. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
As Cameroon's young people prepare to observe National Youth Day on Thursday, February 11, many are questioning their future. As the week-long activities take place, youths are complaining that galloping unemployment and economic insecurity are causing many of them to lose confidence in their own country. More than 30,000 graduate from the university each year, but fewer than 10% are gainfully employed. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Are among thousands gathered in the southwestern Cameroon town of Tiko for the launch of National Youth Day activities. They sing, despite growing unemployment, underemployment and mounting insecurity, especially in the northern part of the country where Boko Haram attacks are frequent. 24-year-old university graduate Stanley Beke says he wants to join the many youths who have left Cameroon in search of greener pastures in developed countries but lacks the financial means.
It is really frustrating for a youth to leave school after having some degree and realize that there is no job in the country. That's why you find many youths forcing themselves to go overseas. Some of them lock themselves into the ship, just to find themselves somewhere out there. Many youths only want to leave the country because they don't see any future in this country.
The president of Cameroon's National Youth Council, Jean-Marc Afesimbafo, says the main problem is that Cameroon's educational system, created before independence to train civil servants, is outdated. He says if education were professionalized, Cameroon would be training youths who can create jobs instead of youths who expect to be recruited into the already saturated civil service.
We are told in China today, calculators are coming up from secondary schools in China. We can do it in Cameroon and contribute our own part in the development of Cameroon. And the head of state, he talked a lot about technological development. And we know we can't talk about emergence without industrial and technological development.
The Director General of Cameroon's National Employment Fund, Mote Abideas, says besides giving loans to youths to start businesses or open farms and breed livestock, they have negotiated with Cameroon enterprises to recruit youths and train them in various professional fields. He says such companies will get a tax break.
We have about 100,000 enterprises in Cameroon. If half of those enterprises, that means 50,000 enterprises, recruit just 1 year on paper, that means we will be able to put in the job 50,000 young people in the enterprises this year. Imagine that some enterprises recruit 2 or 3 young people. How much we will have?
According to the World Factbook, the unemployment rate in Cameroon is 30%. Cameroon's National Institute of Statistics reports a 70% underemployment rate. Cameroon's Minister of Youth Affairs and Civic Education, Mununa Futsu, says such figures are making Cameroonian youths vulnerable to terrorist groups. The 50th Cameroonian National Youth Day is being celebrated under the theme Youth, Citizenship, and the Fight Against Insecurity for an Emerging Cameroon. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Today's Wednesday, February 10th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 17 and a half minutes past the hour. Former hostage Jocelyn Elliott arrived in Burkina Faso's capital, Ouagadougou, earlier this week, just a couple of days after being released by a jihadist group linked to Al-Qaeda. The terrorist group had kidnapped the Australian citizen and her husband in a remote part of the country in mid-January. Speaking to the media, she said she wants to pursue her efforts to obtain the release of her husband and keep working in the country. Emily Yob reports.
After 3 weeks of detention in the hands of a terrorist group linked to Al-Qaeda, former hostage Jocelyn Elliott's first words were for the people of Burkina Faso. She said she wants to thank the people of Burkina for their support during her absence. 76-year-old Elliott was kidnapped along with her husband, Kenny Elliott, in a remote location in northern Burkina Faso, close to the border with Mali and Niger on January 15th. The Australian couple had been living in the area for more than 40 years. They established and run the sole medical facility in the small town of Djibo. After the kidnapping, the people of Djibo organized a rally and turned to social media to campaign for the couple's release.
Je veux bien être avec mon mari bientôt.
Elliott says she hopes her husband will soon be free so they can resume their life in Djibo. Burkina Faso's president, Roch-Marc Christian Kabore, thanked neighboring Niger for its role in Elliott's release, but said the effort to free Elliott's husband must continue.
Le travail doit se poursuivre parce que Dr. Elliott n'a pas été encore libéré.
Kabore said he hopes Dr. Elliott will be released in the coming days. Burkina Faso has been increasingly targeted by Islamic terrorist groups that have been active in the neighboring country in the Sahel region, raising fear that Islamic violence could spread to other parts in West Africa. Emily Yob for VOA News in Abidjan.
Women's groups in Jonglei State, South Sudan, are calling on state officials to appoint a female deputy governor. They argue that appointing a woman to the position will boost the role of women in implementing the current peace agreement. Jacob Achek has the story from the Jonglei State capital, Boa.
Speaking in Arabic, the head of the Women Association in Jonglei State, Sara Achuay, says there are several women capable of being deputy governors. But she says men are unlikely to accept their demand.
موضوع بتاع الديكتي جوفرنر ده ممكن نقدر عليه.
Since this war started, we as women did not run away from the country. Then why, when it comes to government and positions, they are saying there's war in the country, we did not run away? Really, this is a serious issue. We as women are capable of holding this position.
Women rights activist Ayan Queer Ajak agree. The former chairperson of the Jonglei State Women Association says men are using the ongoing instability in part of the country as an excuse to deny women leadership positions. She says during a recent Jonglei community meetings, it's become clear that some men do not believe women can be leaders.
When we went for the meeting, for the community meeting, it was difficult for the elderly people to understand that the young lady could contest for the position of deputy governor. The difficulties I got was that they said there is insecurity in the state and this position should not be given to a lady.
Ajak says she will run for one of the positions at the state level in the next general election scheduled for 2018. No women were appointed to head any of President Kiir's newly created 28 states. For VOA News, I'm Jacob Achek in Bor.
The International Federation of Red Cross and the Red Crescent Societies is appealing for $2.3 million in emergency funds to help communities control the mosquito that is spreading the Zika virus in nearly 30 countries in the Americas. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The International Red Cross says it is taking action in response to the alarming spread of the Zika virus throughout the Americas. Brazil has recorded more than 4,000 cases of microcephaly, a disease that causes brain damage in newborns. The World Health Organization has declared Zika a global health emergency because of its suspected link to this disease. The Red Cross is mobilizing its large volunteer force in affected communities to help them clear up the trash and areas where the mosquitoes can breed, so eggs laid do not hatch months later, and to make sure communities sustain these activities to ensure long-lasting disease control. The IFRC's Director of Health, Julie Lynn Hall, says the Aedes aegypti mosquito, which spreads the virus, also transmits dengue, which kills more than 25,000 people a year. She notes children drink the dirty water in which mosquitoes breed. This, she says, can lead to diarrhea, which kills about 800,000 children under five every year.
So the clear-up, the clean-up, and the keep-it-up is extremely important for Zika, but it will also help with dengue and diarrhea illness.
Hall says people living in slums and urban areas are most at risk, but she warns against communities in less affected areas from becoming complacent. She tells VOA the mosquitoes can fly up to 200 meters by themselves from where they hatch, but notes they also love to hitch a ride.
So they're perfectly capable of getting a lift on a plane, on a boat, inside tires, inside bamboo that's moved around the world. And of course, we live in an extremely globalized world now with a lot of trade and travel of people around the world.
Health officials say it will take years for a vaccine against Zika to be developed. In the meantime, they say the best measures people can take against the virus are vector control, along with prevention and personal protection. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. The Democratic Republic of Congo head of state Joseph Kabila presented a brand new Toyota Land Cruiser Prado to each member of their national football team, the Leopards, in Kinshasa on Tuesday. The team earned this reward for lifting the trophy at the just concluded Orange Africa Nations Championship CHAN in Rwanda. The Leopards beat Mali 3-0 in Sunday's finals to lift the trophy for the second time. They also won the inaugural edition of CHAN in 2009. In Rwanda, the Confederation of African Football's second vice president, Amani Kamara, says Rwanda has what it takes to host Africa's premier football event, the Orange Africa Cup of Nations, AFCON. Kamara confirmed to the media in Kigali that Rwanda satisfied all conditions required to stage the just-concluded Orange Africa Nations Championship, CHAN, which are identical to those required to host AFCON. Kamara says it is now up to Rwanda's Football Federation and the Rwanda government to consider bidding to stage the AFCON in 2026. 6. Meanwhile, former Africa club champions El Ahly beat arch rivals and Egyptian Premier League champions Zamalek 2-0 in Africa's biggest derby on Tuesday night. Although this is a derby between rivals based in Africa's largest city, Cairo, El Ahly opted to stage their home encounter at the military-owned Borg El Arabi Stadium in Alexandria, some 200 kilometers north of the Cairo, for safety reasons. Security authorities in Alexandria, Egypt's second largest city, made sure the match was played behind closed doors, as has been the case since the Port Said Stadium's tragedy in 2012. Elsewhere, Senegal play Mexico in a friendly match in Miami, Florida State in the United States of America today, Wednesday. Finally, in cricket, Namibia play England in the semifinals of the Super League category at the ICC Under-19 Cricket World Cup in Fatula in Bangladesh today, Wednesday. Earlier on, Zimbabwe beat South Africa by 8 wickets in the semifinals of the plate category in Cox's Bazaar. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 10th. On this day in 1992, renowned African-American author Alex Haley died. Haley became famous for his publication of the novel Roots, which traces his ancestry back to Africa and covers 7 American generations as they are taken slaves to the United States. The book was adapted to a television series and woke up an interest in genealogy, particularly among African Americans. Also on this day in 1989, Ronald Brown was elected national chairman of the U.S. Democratic Party and became the first African-American to hold the post. Brown was later appointed Secretary of Commerce under the Clinton administration in 1994. On this day in 1927, African-American opera singer Leontine Price was born in Laurel, Mississippi. She achieved international fame for her brilliant voice. Price performed in many operas, including Aida, a story about an Ethiopian princess. On this day in 1964, the U.S. Congress passed the Civil Rights Act. The law prohibited any state or local government office from discriminating against black people in employment and public accommodations. Also on this day in 1992, former heavyweight boxing champion Mike Tyson was found guilty of raping Desiree Washington, a Miss Black America contestant. He was given a 10-year prison term with 4 years suspended. On this day in African history in 1985, Nelson Mandela rejected South African President P.W. Botha's offer of a conditional release. And on this day in African history in 1980, President Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe narrowly escaped a second assassination attempt when a bomb exploded behind his limousine. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 10th. Congratulations to Bruce Ujiomo of Estako, East Local Government in Edo State, Nigeria. You are the winner of our February 9th question. Which civil rights leader wanted to build a black empire in Africa? The answer, Marcus Mosiah Garvey. Now here is our question for today, February 10th. Who was the first African-American to receive the Pulitzer Prize? Once again, who was the first African-American to receive the Pulitzer Prize? Send your answers to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. And that's it for this Wednesday, February 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Butter saying have a lovely day, Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll focus on the rising concerns over the global spread of the Zika virus. Join me, Esther Githui-Ewart, as guest host and health experts as we discuss the Zika virus. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.